You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
If we run into such debts that we must be taxed in our meat and in our drink, if we can have any drink, in our necessaries and our comforts, in our labours and our amusements, for our callings and our creeds, that our people must come to labour 16 hours in the 24 and give the earnings of 15 of these to the government for their debts and daily expenses, and the 16 being insufficient to afford us bread, we must live as they do now on oatmeal and potatoes, have no time to think, no means of calling the mismanagers to account, but be glad to obtain subsistence by hiring ourselves to rivet their chains around the necks of our fellow sufferers. And this is the tendency of all human governments. A departure from principle in one instance becomes a precedent for a second, and that second for a third, and so on, till the bulk of society is reduced to mere automatons of misery, to have no sensibilities left but for sinning and suffering. And the forehorse of this frightful team is public debt. Taxation follows that, and in its train, wretchedness and oppression. Certainly worth recalling the words of one of the founding fathers of the US, Thomas Jefferson, in a week where we've had calls for increased taxes to fund the vaccine rollout here in South Africa, revelations that we'll be paying over the top for the Serum Institute stock due to government lethargy, and further evidence of the tyranny of incompetence that taxpayers are saddled with. And you juxtapose that against the impressive inaugural address by US President Joe Biden and his team hitting the ground running. It couldn't be starker. To review the week that was, I'm joined now by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Warwick, an interesting week, no doubt. Despite load shedding and the vaccine fiasco, foreigners continue to buy South African bonds after buying some $38 billion in the last 2 months of 2020, another $5.5 billion year to date. And foreigners have even returned to the JSE so far this year as we see a trend towards emerging markets. So it looks like global themes once again supersede the country's woes. The question is, will it last?
I think it will basically last as long as the cocktail looks right for foreign investors. The average foreign investor is often really quite unconcerned with the minutiae of domestic problems such as load shedding and so on, as long as it does not impact upon ability to repay or the overall real yield of the instrument. And certainly South African bonds are offering a very high real yield despite the bullish run that they've had lately. If we look at South Africa's prospects for repayment, to me, they're actually starting to look quite a lot better. The commodities bill is back in the box, and the commodities bill is one of the primary drivers of commodity currencies such as the South African rand, Brazilian real, Aussie dollar, Canadian loonie, and so on and so forth. And if you have a look at that CRB, I mean, that has been steadily and unwaveringly rising since the March lows of last year. Mm. So from that point of view, I'm happy to believe in the short term that there's continued appetite for South African, certainly bonds, while we have such a low inflationary prospect. To a lesser degree, we may see some appetite for our equities.
Now, the CRB that you refer to is obviously the commodities index, which has shown that commodities, as you say, are on a tearaway. How sustainable is this? What do you see as the key driver behind the commodity bull cycle that we're in?
Well, the basic driver is that pretty much everywhere, countries are looking to restart their economies, and they're looking to do it with relatively simple Keynesian mechanisms. So that might mean new dams, roads, various forms of infrastructure, and that kind of activity consumes large amounts of cement, steel, copper, and other basic industrial minerals, and then imports of coal, for example, for the energy to drive the manufacturing inputs to this kind of production. All in all, it's a relatively positive cocktail for SA. I guess the key issue is, will we actually exploit this commodity bull or squander it yet again, as we've done the past two cycles?
It doesn't pass notice that many of the corporate financiers that I chat to are starting to lick their lips at the potential of renewed M&A activity in the South African market, which does tend to indicate that there is a greater degree of comfort around the MPRDA in particular, which for so long has meant that South Africa was just bypassed on that global super cycle highway when it comes to commodities. I want to come back, Raymond, to monetary policy in all of this. And yesterday we had the SARB holding a close call again, 3-2. And considering the macro scene that Warwick has just laid out, the fact that the rand is well supported as we see foreigners buying our equities and our bonds, and that inflation is pretty well in check, a lot of the high frequency data points are pointing to a slower economy. This does look like a missed opportunity to cut marginally again.
Hi, Michael. Look, I think we must start with the fact that there was a 3-2 vote on this matter at the Monetary Policy Committee. And that narrow vote in itself tells you a story, that there is a difference of opinion about how you assess the balance of risks on the inflation and on the growth fronts. And I think that's not only in the MPC, but also among quite a few of our economists. I think the important point and the point of departure for discussion, we mustn't regard a one vote majority as a new sort of gospel on our economy. It's a matter to be debated. It's not just a technical matter, in my view. It's a judgment call. And in my judgment, I think that the minority is right and the majority is wrong. But that's a difference of opinion, a perfectly respectable difference of opinion. Now, I think we need to recall that the background is that a year ago, or a little less than a year ago, the Reserve Bank did respond very promptly by indeed cutting interest rates as we were hit by the COVID-19. So that's the background. And we want to keep interest rates as low as possible for as long as possible, because that's where we are now. I think the issue now is simply, can we go a little further, given the fact that the pandemic has worsened, that we're losing some of the momentum in our economy, and that we need to look at the bigger picture. So apart from keeping rates as low as possible, can we go a little further? And that really was what the debate was all about yesterday. But I'm less concerned about that. But I'm more concerned about what the quarterly projection model is now saying. Huh. Because that's where we're supposed to be going if we were to follow that in a mechanistic way in the next few months. It's now moved an increase in interest rates to the second and third quarters of this year. I don't know what planet it's living on, quite frankly, because at the moment we mustn't even be talking about that. So I think we must park that for a moment and bring our best judgment to bear on what we need to do with interest rates for the rest of this year, given the fact that last year the Reserve Bank acted very, very promptly and very surely about what needs to be done. Of course, it can't go that much further now, but the question is, you want to see a flexible attitude to take an opportunity to keep interest rates as low as possible for as long as possible, accepting, as we always say before someone chips in and says it, we don't ask monetary policy or interest rates to do the heavy lifting for our growth and for our job growth. We look to the economic reforms and other policies that are meant to drive this economy, because one of the big risks we face at the moment, and this is where I think it seems to me that the growth forecast of the Reserve Bank of 3.6% this year, which they've upped by 0.1% over what they said in November, seems to be a little bit optimistic. I hope they're right. But there are a number of other high-frequency data which has come out lately, which points to the fact that maybe we ought to be trimming our forecast for this year. But I think that's something we'll get into in other parts of our discussion today. I think the important point is I would have liked to have seen, without without wanting to make a huge barricade matter about it, what is 25 basis points between friends? It's not a big issue, but it's just a pity that that opportunity was not taken to be a little more flexible, given the fact that I think there's been a deterioration in the economic data since the Reserve Bank last spoke in November last year.
And it's also, Raymond, about messaging. And very often, when you're looking at the statements out of the MPC, whether or not the messaging is consistent. And there was Deputy Governor Kassim at a conference towards the back end of last year who stressed in his concluding remarks that the Monetary Policy Committee and the Reserve Bank were looking at the output gap in the economy through this crisis very closely. That is the difference between what our potential growth rate is and what our actual growth rate and output is going to be. And for as long as that gap is like the hippo's jaws that the finance minister loves referencing, that monetary policy will remain accommodative. Now, read between the lines there, that says that rates will be low for as long as the economy is not growing at its potential. And obviously, while inflation isn't a big risk, there was no mention of that in this particular part of the statement yesterday when they mentioned the quarterly prediction model forecasting another two rate hikes. So I thought there was a bit of mixed messaging.
Well, I think that is so, which is why I think those who are in the minority on the MPC have been pushing that view. I think they've been saying, look, we need to be responsive in an unusual set of circumstances. My plea is we cannot be mechanistic now. You've got to use your best judgment and say we're in an unusual set of circumstances. This is where the data is going. And given the fact that we were responsive a year ago, we still have to be responsive, even if we can't be responsive on the same scale. It comes back not so much to the technicalities of whether you're right or wrong, but whether you're giving a message of confidence and an injection that we are supporting the economy and we will go that extra mile if it's necessary to do so. And I think that is what was missing. But as I said before, I think the real solutions actually lie elsewhere. And so I think we should move on and to see what other external and internal factors will shape our economic outlook for the rest of this year.
And one of the major external factors, Warwick, has got to be the global shift that we're seeing. And this week, we saw the inauguration of Joe Biden. Broadly has been received by markets as a positive move because of a peaceful transition of power. I think markets will now start to digest what these big stimulus packages effectively mean for the US economy in the short to the medium term. What issues face investors now under a Biden America?
I think the key issue, Michael, is what does the proceeds of this very large proposed stimulus package go towards? Is it in sufficient time? And does it provide enough of a boost to actually make the economy get on its own footing and start stumbling forward? I think realistically, while it certainly is going to be helpful, we won't really have sufficient confidence until there is a step down from the virus scare footing that we're on. So, you know, debates aside as to how dangerous is COVID, et cetera, the reality is there's been a sufficient crimping of confidence by the virus and the numbers and so on and so forth that a capable vaccination campaign is, I think, the primary outcome required, not only just in the US, but globally. Because a massive part of the whole destruction of economies relates to its interconnectedness and the degree of travel, whether it is for tourism, whether it is for business, the physical exchange of ideas, not just through electronic media, but academics and scientists working together, joint projects, etc., etc. These are all part of a normality that's been seriously clamped down on and needs to be resuscitated. And hence, even if one has issues surrounding vaccination and the efficacy thereof, and was the whole thing a con, blah, 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 which is an ad nauseum discussion and not appropriate for this forum. It still encompasses a bunch of concerns that can only be put aside by vaccination.
Bringing it now back home, Raymond, to South Africa, and it really is behoven upon the South African government to get moving now with this vaccination program, because if you look at the high frequency data, this economy is still really laboring under the effects of this lockdown and this renewed level 3 lockdown. We've had mining data out, Stats SA reporting that mining production was down 11.6% year on year in November. Retail sales worse than expected in November as well. How are you reading the local economic tea leaves at the moment under level 3?
Well, I think, Michael, as you've indicated and as we said in the first part of our discussion, we've entered this year with somewhat weakened data. And I think the important point is not to wring our hands about it, but simply take note that we're not in as good a position as we thought we might be as we move towards the end of last year. And I think what has happened with the level 3 lockdown, which has been renewed, the fact is that its impact on the value chain is beginning to widen. We talk in popular language simply about the tourism sector, or the hospitality sector, or the alcohol sector, but even the alcohol sector, the value chain is now having a backlash in the agricultural sector. And farmers are now also indicating that their inputs are getting bottled up and so forth. So it's tremendously important that we understand what this cost is, and it's rising every day, but that we understand that there is hope on the horizon in terms of the vaccine. And this simply injects much more urgency and must emphasize to us how important the priority of getting the vaccine, not only getting it, being able to pay for it, which I assume we can, and we'll come to that, but above all, getting people vaccinated. I said before, it's vaccination that weaponizes the vaccine. And until you get to that point, you will find that you will be limited in being able to open up the economy and build the sort of confidence that you want as to where we might go later in the year with our economic performance. So it's tremendously important that what the data is telling us, not only that we must do what we can with our policies to sustain momentum in the economy, but above all, to ensure that the hope for the future now rests on the speedy and efficient access and implementation to the vaccine. And that's tremendously important. And I think that must be the overriding priority. In fact, I like to say that the watchwords for this year are indeed vigilance and vaccine.
Vigilance and vaccines, as we see Johann Rupert taking the fast route to getting vaccinated over in Switzerland, Warwick, and that's caused something of a storm in a social media teacup, I fear, today, considering that his family donated R1 billion to the Solidarity Fund, which is going to help fund the entire country's vaccine rollout strategy. I certainly don't begrudge Mr. Rupert the opportunity. I think anyone in his position will probably do the same thing. And really, we should be asking questions now about our own strategy. Can we quantify, can we begin to quantify the economic cost of a delayed vaccine rollout strategy?
Michael, I suppose with respect to the first point on Rupert as just another example of whataboutitis and how easily it spreads, particularly in an environment where people are basically all as tense as piano wire. I think as far as the cost of the vaccine rollout, well, there's actually a number of costs that could come up for discussion. First is, what is the cost if we go for the Serum Institute, and that's say $5 times 40 million people, or we could say, well, how much is it if we go for another provider, which is $20 times 40 million people, and then we get to the cost if we don't do it, and that's called opportunity cost. And quite frankly, that's the biggest cost of the lot. You have to get back onto the vaccination footing, whether you feel that the virus caused all of the economic damage that we've seen in the last year, or whether the lockdowns caused the damage. Here's the thing, even in places that went laissez-faire, like Sweden, we saw enormous damage incurred through simple lack of confidence. So either way, you have to get around to it, I should say. Mm. And it's really a trade-off between how fast can you do it and how much do the units cost. And I think that the ponderous tendering processes of government need to be looked at closely here, but obviously we need to be sure that it is also honestly and effectively done, that we don't buy doses of vaccine that are simply stuck in a storeroom somewhere and junked. That kind of dishonesty has to be watched for, and that you actually buy a virus, a vaccine that you can actually distribute.
And that is effective, just on that point, Warwick, against the new variant. There are some concerns as to how effective the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is going to be against this new variant. And that said, we are still awaiting those results from the phase 3 clinical trials from Johnson & Johnson. The benefit of that particular vaccine is it's a one-dose vaccine versus the others, which are primarily two-dose vaccines. And the fact that we also have Aspen manufacturing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine here in South Africa. So as much as we are bemoaning the slow rollout, we also don't want to jump the gun, purchase an Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine and see that the J&J might be better suited here in South Africa. So there are still a few technicalities that have to be ironed out here, Warwick.
Certainly. I mean, reliability is generally not a common South African attribute, certainly in some quarters. So the actual possibility of a single jab versus two jabs certainly does make that particular Johnson & Johnson jab very attractive. And of course, the fact that it's has the possibility to be supplied locally, for sure, another very positive attribute.
Raymond, just as we've got a minute or two to go, the president has urged black business to participate in the COVID-19 vaccine rollout. Surely the question to the South African public and for the economy at large, it should be really around what makes us roll this vaccine out in the most speedy, effective, low cost and transparent manner. This isn't now an opportunity to ensure that various tenderpreneurs get cut in on the deal. And that's why I think there is so much anxiety at the moment, because there is still a certain opacity, a lack of transparency around how this is going to happen.
I think, Michael, what's important here is we've all agreed, and whether it's government or business or labor, other stakeholders, we've agreed on the overriding importance of combating this pandemic with a vaccine sooner rather than later. That means perhaps all hands to the pumps or all hands to the vaccine, or all hands to the syringes, whichever way you want to look at it. But what I'm trying to say is that you may not love capitalists, but use them. They get the job done. And so I think it's tremendously important that we be colorblind in who we mobilize in order to get this job done. Because whether you're government or the nation at large, I think we're all at one on this agenda. We want it done. And what's important here is that apart from this interministerial committee, which is being chaired by the deputy president, which I think in principle is the right thing. And I myself said a few weeks ago that in the United Kingdom, they had appointed a separate minister for vaccine deployment, taking it away from the Minister of Health and saying, that's your dedicated job, get it done. Now, I think here in our circumstances, what you want to supplement that with is to say there is a dynamic private sector out there with a distribution network which can be put at your disposal to expedite this process. And I think it's tremendously important that we see this very much as a public-private sector partnership to combat and to roll back this pandemic. And I think that is the message that's got to go out to the country in order to do the best job we can to roll back this whole COVID-19 disaster.
And sadly, government has a great partner in SAB with one of the best distribution reputations and networks in the country. And what have they done? They've gone and backed them into an adversarial corner around the alcohol ban. On that point, we're going to have to leave it off. Raymond Parsons of the Northwest University and Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, with your weekly wrap.